Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today is the 4th of July, a day that people are celebrating their independence, even those people that are not really independent. So today we're going to play a rebroadcast of a few programs that will leave us with something to think about. I wish I had Frederick Douglass to share his wonderful speech, What to the American Slave is the 4th of July. But you can look that up and read it. Definitely food for thought. So we're going to start out with Malcolm X, who is going to talk about African-American history. And this is, it's African-American History Part 1. It's an excerpt. And then I think we're going to move right into maybe Erica Huggins, who's talking about the Black Power mixtape.
You got to get on the basis of being Jews. And Irish got to get on the basis of being Irish. Now, what basis you and I going to get together on? We've got to have some kind of basis. But of course we mentioned the only basis that we've got to get together on, they trick us by telling our leaders, you know, that anything that's all Black will put segregation in the dirt.
Step farther, they get you again on this bottom.
they have another track wherein they make it look criminal. If any of us, again, who has a rope around his neck, or one of the things put around his neck, if you do anything to stop the man from putting that rope around your neck, that's violent. And again, this bourgeois Negro, who's trying to be polite and respectable and all, he never wants to be identified with violence. So he lets them do anything to him. And he sits there submitting to it, non-violently, just so he can keep his image of responsibility. He dies with a responsible image. He dies with a polite image. But he dies. The man who's irresponsible and impolite, he keeps his life. But that responsible Negro, he'll die every day. But if the irresponsible one dies, he takes some of those with him who were trying to make him die. So the era that we're living in is an era in which we see the people in the East on the rise and the people in the West on the decline. That is, the dark world is rising and the white world or the Western world is having its power curtailed. This is happening, and it's happening every day. Even the state right there in Saigon, in South Vietnam, don't you realize that 20 years ago, those little people over there didn't have a chance? All it needs to be a battleship to sail up to the coastline, and everybody over there would bow down. Yes, the boss. That's how they said the same as you said it over here. But not now. Now they don't just the nobody's boss. They give them a right when the son boss clean on out of there. The entire East, the dark world, is on the rise. Whether you like it or not. And if the dark world rises up, it puts the white world on the spot. It puts the Western world on the spot. And it puts you and me on the spot. Why does it put us on the spot? Because although we're in the West, we're from the East. Many, many black Americans don't realize this. You are not of the West. You are in the West. You're not a Western. You're from the East. You're not white. You're in the right world. That doesn't make you white. You're as black as you ever were. Because you're just in the right world. And next month, they'll come up to show you another trip. They'll come at you and me next month with this Negro History Week, they call it. And during this week comes around once every year. And during this 1 week, they drowned us with propaganda about Negroes in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama. Never do they take us back across the water back home. They take us down home, but they never give up the history of back home. They never give us enough information to let us know what were we doing before we ended up in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Texas, some of those other prison states. They give us the impression with Negro History Week that we were cotton pickers all of our lives. Cotton pickers, orange growers, mammies and uncles for the white man in this country. This is our history when you talk in terms of Negro History Week. They might tell you about one or two people who took a peanut and made another white man rich. George Washington Carver, he was a man. But he died broke. He made poor rich. So he wasn't doing anything for himself and his people. He got a good name for us. But what did we get out of it? The master got it. It's like a dog who runs out in the woods and grabs a rabbit. No matter how hungry the dog is, does he eat? No. He takes it back and lays it at the boss's feet. And the boss skins it, takes the meat, and gives the dog the bone. And the dog is going right on hungry again. But he didn't know. He could have gotten the rabbit and ate it for himself. And brought something to his party to win it. So he can outrun the ball. But it's the same way with you and me. Every contribution we make, we don't make it for our people. We make it for the man. We make it for our man. He gets the benefit from it. We die, it's not for our people. We die for him. We don't die for our home and our house. We die for his house. We don't die for our achievements we made in the Western Hemisphere under the tutelage of the white man. So that whatever achievement that was made in the Western Hemisphere that the spotlight is put upon, this is the white man's shrewd way of taking credit for whatever we accomplished. But he never ever saw the accomplishment that we made prior to being brought here. This is another trick. The worst trick of all is when he names us Negro and calls us Negro. And then when we call ourselves that, we end up tricking ourselves. As my brother Spanish was on the screen the other night talking with Leonard Green about the word Negro. I wish he wouldn't have gone so fast, but he was in a position to have done a very good job. And but he was right in saying that we're not Negroes. And have never been. Until we were brought here, and made into that, we were scientifically produced by the white man. And whenever you see somebody who calls himself a Negro, he's a product of Western civilization. Not only Western civilization, but Western crime. The Negro, as he is called, or calls himself in the West, is that evidence that can be used against Western civilization today. One of the main reasons we're called Negro is so we won't know who we really are. And when you call yourself that, you don't know who you really are. You don't know what you are. You don't know where you came from. You don't know what is yours. And as long as you call yourself a Negro, nothing is yours. No languages. You can't lay claim to any language, not even English. You messed it up. You can't lay claim to any name, any type of name. That will identify you as something that you should be. You can't lay claim to any culture as long as you use the word Negro to identify yourself. It attaches you to nothing. It doesn't even identify your color. If you talk about one of them, they call themselves white. Don't they? Or they might call someone else Puerto Rican to identify them. Mind you how they do this. When they call him a Puerto Rican, they're giving him a better name. Because there is a place called Puerto Rico. You know, at least that you know where he came from. So let's say, white, Puerto Rican, and Negro. Pick up on that. That's a prayer, brother. White is legitimate. It means that's what color they are. Puerto Rican tells you that there's something else, came somewhere else that they're here now. Negro doesn't tell you anything. I mean, nothing. Absolutely nothing. What do you identify with? Tell me. Nothing. What are you attached to? What are you attached to it? Nothing. It's completely in the middle of nowhere. And when you call yourself that, that's where you are, right in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't give you a language, because there's no such thing as a Negro language. It doesn't give you a country, because there's no such thing as a Negro country. It doesn't give you a culture, there's no such thing as a Negro culture. It doesn't exist. The land doesn't exist. The culture doesn't exist. The language doesn't exist. And the man doesn't exist. They take you out of existence by calling you a Negro. And you can walk around in front of them all day long from then on, and they act like they don't even see you. But you see, you made yourself not existent. It's a person who has no history. And by having no history, he has no culture. Just as a tree without roots is dead. A people without history or a cultural group also become a dead people. And when you look at us, those of us who are called Negro, we're called that because we're like a dead people. We have nothing to identify ourselves as part of the human family. You know, you take a tree. You can tell what kind of tree it is by looking at the leaves. If the leaves are gone, you can look at the bottom and tell what kind it is. But when you find a tree with the leaves gone and the bark gone, everything gone, you call that a what? A stump. And you can't identify a stump as easily as you can identify a tree. And this is the position that you and I are in here in America. Formerly, we could be identified by the names we wore when we came here. When we were first brought here, we had different names. When we were first brought here, we had a different language. And these names and this language identify the culture that we were brought from, the land that we were brought from. And in identifying that, we were able to point toward what we had produced. our net worth. But once our lane was...
Well, that was Malcolm X, and while he was... that was Black History Lesson Part 1. And while he was speaking, gosh, I was thinking about so many other interviews that I could play that sort of look at the question about independence and about freedom and about justice. And I am going to play a selection from Renee Marie's Voices of My Beautiful Country, and I'm going to play her piece. Which I'm looking for. Lift Every Voice. And then I think I might shift into Tim Wise. I know I mentioned Erica Huggins, and I also mentioned Michelle Alexander, both really, really thoughtful women. And but I'm not sure exactly. I think it might be Tim Wise. So but here is Renee Marie, Lift Every Voice, sung to the tune of Star Spangled Banner. After all, today is July 4th, Independence Day, here in the United States of America.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven. Ring with a harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicings run high as the loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of hope that the present has brought us. Facing the
your new book, Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority, it sort of continues your, you know, the type of writing and type of issues that you bring up, this truth-telling and soul-searching kind of writing and that you do around exploration of a white skin privilege and structural racism and things like that. I was wondering why this book now? It's a really, I mean, all the books are personal, but this is a really personal one, similar to your first book, White Like Me.
Well, you know, as I was thinking about the sort of current political moment, and of course I had written Colorblind most recently, and it was a much more sort of analytical and I'm not going to say academic book, but it was much more about, you know, analysis and research and you know, heavily footnoted and really more about sort of developing a more intellectual theory, which was fine. I mean, it certainly was a valuable and I think is a valuable book. But I started to notice that in the last, you know, year to two since I really sat down to write the previous book, there had just been a much more, nasty edge of racism and racial commentary developing in the country, and a lot more personal, if you will, reaction to the current moment on the part of a lot of white Americans. And as I began to think about why that was happening, I also began to think about what it would take to respond to it. And it seemed to me that, and really all the evidence, research evidence actually says this too, is that at the end of the day, what gets people to honestly reflect on issues like race, or anything that's at all controversial, is not so much a bunch of facts and figures and studies as it is really, you know, to the point, personal kinds of reflection. And so in the current moment, what I identified or tried to identify were a few current trends that I think are sort of propelling a lot of this white racial anxiety forward in the current moment. And I identified four of them. One, of course, is the election of a black president, which for some folks challenges their notion of what leaders are supposed to look like, particularly when that president has what many consider an exotic name, an exotic background, you know, a father who's actually from Africa, not even African American, grew up in Hawaii, which for a lot of white folks is still just a tourist destination. I think they still don't really see it as an honest-to-God state. The second, of course, is the economic meltdown. So you have white folks for the first time in three generations being confronted by a level of economic security that we're not used to. And then we've got a popular culture, which has quite shifted in the last 25 to 30 years. You know, it was 25 years ago or so that MTV wouldn't even play videos by black artists except for Michael Jackson. And now we have a popular culture that's thoroughly interwoven across racial and ethnic lines, which challenges, I think, the normalcy that white Americans had long taken for granted with regard to, you know, our ability to at least control the cultural look of America. And then the final thing, and maybe the biggest, of course, is the demographic shift in the U.S., so that within, you know, 25 years, as we know, 30 years, half the population will be folks of color, half will be white. So the ability of white Americans to sort of assume that we are the prototype of an American, that we are the textbook definition of an American, is being challenged on all of those levels, economic, political, cultural, and even purely numerical or demographic. And so what that means is that for the first time, really, whiteness is being made visible to white people. It's always been visible to people of color, but to white folks, we've been able to sort of hide in our own skin, if you will, and not have to think about ourselves as a racialized people. And once we have now begun to see that that's not true, that we have a racial identity as well, and that it means something, that it has historically meant privilege, that it still does, and that it's being challenged, that creates a lot of anxiety. And the question that I'm trying to address in this book is, which direction will we go with that anxiety? Will we turn to more solidarity with people of color so as to diminish our anxiety, or will we react by circling the wagon, so to speak, and trying to hold on to that diminishing privilege at great risk, I think, to ourselves and to the country?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And when I saw the title of the book, I thought of James Baldwin's letter to his nephew, The Fire Next Time, and I wondered, were you at all influenced in the style of this particular book and this particular message by that historic document? And it's just brilliant, and it's not, you know, this book is small enough to almost put in one's pocket,
right.
And it's, you know, as you said, you go you know, you sort of lay it out in the beginning of the book that it wasn't going to be scholarly. You didn't want people to have to be, you know, flipping to the back of the chapter and looking at the notes.
Right.
If they want the notes, they can look at the end of the book.
Right.
And so you want it to be really accessible. And you said also that you're probably preaching to the choir.
Right.
But then you say choirs need to rehearse, and I
right.
thought, oh, that's so true. Even the best ones, they have rehearsals.
Right. Well, you know, I honestly, if I could have done this book without notes at all,
mm-hmm.
without any kind of note structure, I would have. And the only reason, of course, that I opted for the style that I did, which was basically just having that back section where I, you know, repeat part of a paragraph and then I tell you where that came from, is because I realize that unfortunately we are so uninformed when it comes to these issues that people won't believe you. You know, if you say something factual about racism in the justice system, there will be folks who just simply will not believe it. So I had to put something in there, but I did want it to read like a letter, and obviously you don't have footnotes in a letter, you know, so I had to sort of compromise a little bit on the style, but not too much. Certainly Baldwin's letter to his nephew was in my mind as I was thinking through the process. Baldwin, more than any writer, living or dead, has influenced me both in terms of how I think about race and how I try to write about race. So it was a combination of that, which I found to be, of course, you know, back in at the time that it was written, an incredibly effective, I guess that was 63, an incredibly effective way to convey the thoughts that Baldwin had at that time. And I also, of course, was piggybacking on this trend of the last 5 or 6 years, where you've had lots of authors, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Naomi Klein, I think, did one, and then even Dinesh D'Souza on the right, you know, doing these books, Letter to a blah, 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 whatever it is. You know, I think Christopher Hitchens did Letter to a Young Contrarian, and Dinesh D'Souza did Letter to a Young Conservative, and Sam Harris did Letter to a Christian Nation. He's, you know, one of the sort of new atheist theorists. And so I think that trend of trying to make your point in the form of sort of an open letter is a pretty effective rhetorical tool. You know, it sort of gets you out of the mode of doing pure memoir or biography, which of course I did in White Like Me, my first book. It also gets you out of the mode of doing a purely academic thing. And I think to some extent it allows you to really speak to people the way that you would speak to them. And it makes it hopefully readable. You know, I've read some of those other letter books, if you will, and they tend to be pretty readable. And they're short, you know, they don't have to be long, and I didn't want this to be long. I wanted it to be punchy. I wanted it to provide the choir with the, you know, sort of rhetorical devices it needs, not so much to convince people on the other side. There's part of me that, you know, yeah, I would love to convince people on the other side, but just as much I'm interested in getting people who already claim to be about something in the white community, people who claim to be against racism and claim to be on the side of the angel, so to speak, to actually demonstrate just how much they really are committed to it. I mean, it seems to me if we would mobilize ourselves, those of us who claim to be about something, it wouldn't matter if we converted the others. You know, it really, the choir, frankly, might be sufficient if we're actually singing, you know. But the problem is sometimes, you know, the choir sits there and there might be a whole row that isn't singing because they don't think they sound good, and they're just trying to, like, hide in the midst of everybody else, you know. So if we're all singing, then we might be able to really change the status quo, but I'm afraid that for many of us, we sit back, you know, and that really has to stop.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And I really like how you sort of state your intentions initially, that that you are including yourself in
right.
in the we,
yeah.
and that you're driven by love.
Yeah.
And also, the way you write it, it might be Dear White America, A Letter to a New Minority, but the other, you know, people that are not
yeah.
white or not a part of the new minority or
yeah.
part of the new majority,
yeah.
you know, also feel that they can also listen in and also participate in this conversation.
Sure.
Because the way it comes out is as if we don't start rethinking the way we think about race,
yeah.
The institutionalizing of race
yeah.
as a way to structure policies and privilege, then the demise of our nation is quickly at hand, so to speak. I mean, we're not going to last much longer if it continues this way. So if you could talk about sort of your love of our nation and what drives you to write these type of books and to you know, spend your life, you know, basically the last, this, you know, recently, I mean, not your whole life, but, you know, these books are, I mean, you have a crusade going here.
Well, you know, I mean, I've been at it in some capacity for 22 years.
Yeah. Is that like half your life or something?
Yeah, a little more than half. Yeah.
Okay,
a little
yeah.
more than half.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I don't know if it's a crusade or if it's just, you know, I'm fortunate that I, you know, was able to figure out what it was I really cared about early. And I think a lot of people, sadly, in our culture don't figure out what they care about or what they're good at or what they are passionate about ever, let alone in their early 20s. So I was fortunate in that regard. I think it's hard to explain to people when you're issuing pretty trenchant critiques of something that you do it out of love. I think particularly for my fellow, you know, white Americans, they're very reluctant to believe that anything like the things that I say could come from a place of love. We've been so conditioned to believe that if we condemn the country's politics, if we condemn the country's systemic culture, that it's out of hatred. You know, we even have a word for it in our country, right? We call it un-American. It's a word that doesn't have any parallel, if you think about it, in any other country, right? Like if you were in Sweden and you were criticizing something the government or the culture or the people of Sweden did, is there even a word for that? Do we say, well, that's un-Swedish? Like, that word doesn't even exist, right? Because in our country, in the United States, we have this sort of grand national narcissism that makes us think that we're above reproach. All the things that we condemn people for criticizing in our own country, we praise them for criticizing in other countries. We call them, you know, patriots, in fact, in other countries when they stand up against their government. When the people of China stand up against their government at Tiananmen Square in 1989, we call them heroes. You know, when people in other countries do it, we call them heroes. And we do it in our country, we call them traitors. So there's that element, which is a national level. And then, of course, you add to that the racial, right? And for white folks, criticizing white racism ends up being heard as condemning white people, which is really sort of ironic. And I sort of try to talk about that both in this book and in White Like Me as well, that there's an irony to that. If you say that being against white racism makes you anti-white, then by definition that would mean that the only way that you could be pro-white people or love white people is to endorse white racism. I mean, you know, by definition it sort of mm-hmm. makes white people and this vicious racism synonymous, and I don't happen to feel like white folks are inherently racist. I reject that notion. I do think we live in a culture of racism and an institutional racist reality that bends each of us and warps us into people who have internalized our notions of racial supremacy. And so it's precisely because I resent that having been done to me. I resent it being done to my two daughters. I resent it being done to my friends and you know, white colleagues. And it's a horrible thing to have happen. And I think that one rejects that and responds to that out of love, not hatred. If I didn't care for those individuals called white, I wouldn't waste my time on working, struggling with us, myself included, the way that others struggled with me. I'd just walk away from the whole thing and not worry about it, you know. But we don't really have that option because, as you said, and as I try to point out in the book, we're really coming up against a time crunch where if we do not figure out how to engage in solidarity across racial lines, the culture is really not economically, politically, socially going to survive for any number of reasons that I go into, the most obvious of which is, you know, that you just can't sustain a healthy society if 50% of your population, the 50% which is of color, is 2 times more likely than the white half to be out of work, 3 times more likely to be poor, 9 years less life expectancy, 1/20th the net worth, you know, double the rate of infant mortality, double the rate of low birth weight kids. I mean, that's just not a recipe. You can't have a nation you can have one that's numerically divided, but it can't be that divided in terms of the opportunity structure and expect to maintain a healthy economy for anyone, white, black, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then you sort of demystify, or you take, like, there's a mythology sort of floating around in in our national consciousness around certain things like imprisonment and education, equal education, equal opportunity that the numbers don't support, as well as over time how things have changed, particularly, and I found it really interesting when you were talking about the prison system and how it went from being more, you know, white people incarcerated, more white men incarcerated, to now, you know, sort of the current numbers. That was really interesting. And then, you know, you talk about the privatization of, you know, public education and, you know, as well as, you know, as you already mentioned, sort of economic opportunity and how, you know, that diminishes quite a bit more when one doesn't have proper education or access to good education, and one might have, you know, a criminal record.
Right.
It's like, oh, you just forget all that, and sort of, and this is sort of like a big statement of some, like, sort of piling it on here because we don't have that much more time. But you know how you start out talking about the 4th of July and you talk about the historic nostalgia,
right,
you know, coupled with historic amnesia.
Right.
And I'm sure you're probably aware of a lot of sort of artists and other conscious, you know, white folks that are trying to undo the damage and trying to educate, or maybe, you know, sort of take the choir into these different rooms for rehearsals, like Dan Hoyle's Real Americans, which is back at the Marsh in San Francisco. And I just met this poet at June Jordan's Poetry for the People's 20th Anniversary this past weekend, Ariel Lucky.
Yeah,
and yeah, and he's got the Searching for White Folks Soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, like you say in the book, and I just mentioned a couple of folks, you know, that you're not alone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I think, look, there have always been, and I try to make this point in the book, too, near the end, there's been a tradition, an alternative, underappreciated, underexplored tradition of white allyship going back literally 400 years to the colonial period in this country, and really even before that, but in Europe. But here, all the way back to the colonial period, white folks whose names we don't learn in school, who stood up against the genocide of indigenous people, stood up against the enslavement of African people, stood up against the theft of half of Mexico in a war of aggression that the United States started on false pretense, stood up against the conquest and ravaging of the Philippines, stood up against every single racist incursion made in, within or abroad by this country. And I'm wanting white folks to connect to that tradition, because I do realize, you know, that when you tell people that the identity they have is a toxic one and that whiteness is a real problem in the world, obviously you're going to have to give them something, you know, to replace that with. People don't appreciate having their identity taken from them, and then you give them nothing. And so what I'm arguing is, look, you have an option. You don't have to connect to whiteness as you've done. There's this alternative tradition of allyship, of cross-racial solidarity. If you're willing to explore it, if you're willing to notice the bravery of it and join and connect with it, you can join this tradition, this long line of white folks, however much longer we wish it were, who have stood up and who have tried to live differently in this skin. And that's a choice we have to make. We have agency. We have free will in this regard. We don't have to be oppressors. Whiteness, white people are not inherently oppressive people, but we live in a system that unfortunately has turned us oftentimes into that. Just like men don't have to be inherently sexist, right? It's something which a patriarchal culture does and inculcates in men, but we have options, and I try to get us to explore those options in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my closing questions, I have two, are, has the response to this particular book been different from your others, and if so, in what way, or how has this response been different? And secondly, was this book easier or harder to write than the others?
Well, it was definitely easier than the others, in the sense that it could pretty much leap out of my skull fully formed without having to sit there and parse the theory and the analytical material that I did for Colorblind, which, again, I mean, it has its value, too. But this was easier, I think, in that regard. As far as the response, I mean, the reaction has been quite similar. You know, each of my books touches a different part of an audience. You know, White Like Me and this one, I think, touch that part of the audience that is looking for that more personal element. Yes, they appreciate the analytical as well. They appreciate the argumentative and the polemic, but it's that personal touch. And then all the books in between, Between Barack and a Hard Place, Colorblind, Speaking Treason Fluently, those touch maybe different portions of the audience. There's so many different folks out there who are interested in this for different reasons. So I think, you know, each of the books sort of serves its own purpose, and I would say the reactions have been similar for each, but maybe from different people. Like the people who really get into Dear White America might be a slightly different group than what would get into Colorblind, but I think in the long run it all serves the same purpose, and I think the more readers that can be brought in to think about these issues who maybe are into reading different kinds of books, you know, the better. And so the reaction's been great. I think people like the brevity of the book. It's very readable. You can read it in easily in a day if you had the time, or 2 days at the most if you wanted to, and get, I think, a lot out of it. And so I think people are appreciating that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And do you have time for, like, one more?
Sure.
Okay. I forgot to mention, I happened to hear, I was just writing down some notes, like, oh, yeah, Occupy Movement.
Yeah.
And we have an election. So the timing is just perfect, you know, that you would come out with this letter. In the form of a book. And I was wondering if you could, when you wrote it, I don't know if you were thinking about the Occupy movement, because I don't know if it was happening.
Yeah, as I was finishing it, it had not started yet. And,
okay.
And it's sort of unfortunate, because that always happens. You know, you're in the middle of a book and you're just about done with it, and you send it to the publisher, and then something big happens that you think, oh, man, I wish I, you know, could have put that in. I've written a few other things elsewhere about it, blog posts and such, and I've talked about it in speeches. And I think that, you know, it's an interesting thing, because on the one hand, obviously, look, any movement that raises these issues of vast wealth disparity in the country is a good thing, and it's had a positive impact, I think, on the narrative. On the other hand, and this is not only my critique, I mean, there are some pretty significant problems with this movement in terms of how it does or does not approach and address race. I think with the exception of the organizers in Oakland, who I think have done a far better job of blending a race analysis into the class analysis, and even there's work to be done. But I think Oakland sort of stands out as a group that's done that. In New York and elsewhere, it's been done, but in fits and starts, where you have a handful of activists who very clearly, I think, see the need to have a strong anti-racist analysis and really bring these issues in. And so they're the folks who have connected with Occupy Harlem, and they're the folks that have, you know, done Occupy the Hood, and the folks who have gone up and protested police brutality in Harlem in particular, and in the Bronx, and a few other places. But across the country, I don't see that as much, and that's going to have to happen. I mean, unless these white left activists come to understand the role that white supremacy has played in keeping the country economically divided. So, for instance, you can't really understand the vast income and wealth disparities and the cutting of social programs and the difference between the haves and have-nots in America unless you understand the way that racism has helped perpetuate that. That is central to the analysis, as I try to explain in this book. And so I think Occupy folks, white Occupy folks, are really going to need to connect to that. And we're going to have to be very careful when we use a narrative like, you know, the one versus the 99, because if we understand racism, and for that matter, if we understand sexism and straight supremacy and all these other systems of oppression, we know that the 99%, they ain't really living the same. You know, to be in the top 5 is way different than to be in the bottom third. To be in the top 25 is way different than to be in the bottom decile or 10%. So it's nice to craft this narrative of solidarity for 99% of the population, but come on. If you're at the 2% mark or the 3% mark, your life is nothing like the person in the bottom 20%. And to pretend that it is, just because you're not the very pinnacle of the owning class, for the sake of solidarity, I think could create some real problems down the line, because there are some very different lifestyles and cleavages that exist between people because of racism, because of sexism, because of straight supremacy, even within that 99%. And for that matter, there are some different class cleavages that exist there. So it's not that we don't use that narrative, but we just have to be very careful. You cannot create solidarity with a slogan. You know, you can only create solidarity by really building the relationships across racial lines, gender lines, sexuality lines, and even different class lines within that 99% if you want to actually move us forward. And so hopefully, you know, that will become part of the Occupy awareness and the Occupy narrative, but we're going to have to wait and see, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I went to Occupy San Quentin on February 20th, and one of the messages that some of the incarcerated persons who had sent messages out to be read to the those gathered said that, like, you know, you talked about the bottom, well, they're the bottom of that bottom.
Yeah, right, right, right. I mean, they're in the 99, but come on, they're not living like people in the free world, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right, exactly.
That's a huge difference, right? And and so we've got to be just very transparent about not presuming that it's as simple as the 1%, and to be perfectly honest, even the 1% is not a unified group. I mean, to be in the top 0.1% means you're living a way different life than people even at the lowest part of the one. Granted, anyone in the one is doing well, but some, even within the one, are living like, you know, like lords of the manor, so to speak, and others are still, relative to them, not nearly in the same position. You know, you could be at the 1% level based on your actual work that you do, earned income perhaps, but you can't be at the top 0.1% if you just based on your own labor. You can only get there based on your exploitation of the labor of others, really. I mean, you have to be a member of the owning class who makes your money from the money you already have from interest, and that's a very different life, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if you are aware that, April 17th is the 40th anniversary of Angola 3. And there's going to be these international actions. And then there's going to be a march on Washington, or get on the bus to Washington for Mumia Abu-Jamal just a week later. And just wondering if, you know, sort of your thoughts around, you know, these mobilizations around these I guess more public cases of imprisonment, and then the second question was about this election year and how you know your books, Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority, because you mentioned the Tea Party, you know, early on in your book, could help people think differently about democracy and the office of president, as well as some of the legislation that's being pushed both locally and federally this year.
Well, taking those in backward order, I hope that the book and the narrative the book tries to put forward will certainly help people interrupt this nostalgia process that that at least you know, one political party seems fully enthralled to, and there are even members of the other who are far too, I guess, solicitous of it. I mean, there's this battle right now within the country, and it's not just a battle about policy, because unfortunately, you know, the differences between the two parties at the level of policy oftentimes are relatively minimal. In some areas, they might be significant, but overall, both parties are completely enthralled, of course, to big money, and far too enthralled to Wall Street, regardless of what they might say. But really, the battle is not so much between these two parties as it is these larger grand assumptions about the country. And on the one side, you know, we have people who are very openly sort of pining away for the America of old. I mean, they say they want their country back. And I assume that when they say that, they aren't just saying, you know, we want to go back to like the day before Obama was elected, or 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, because frankly, the country wasn't doing all that well then for most people. But I assume that they're talking about something quite a bit further back than that. I mean, if you think about the white folks who were saying they want their country back, it's not 27-year-olds, you know, who were just saying, gosh, I'd like to go back to the days of my senior prom. You know, these are old people, by and large, older than, let's say, mid-50s to early 60s, who are talking about going back to a time, really, whether they're thinking of it or not in these terms, that's before the civil rights movement, that's really at a time when they thought America was a really innocent, lovely place. And, of course, it was a horrible, vicious and terroristic place for millions of peoples of color, and it wasn't that great for a lot of white folks either, to be honest. It wasn't great for most white women who still didn't have equal opportunity, even remotely close. It wasn't such a great time for LGBT folks who were white. It wasn't such a great time for working class and low-income white folks. But we have this nostalgic mythology, and it's very dangerous. I mean, nostalgia in any country is dangerous because it threatens to bring back a period of entrenched hegemonic domination by a few who feel like they're losing control of their country, and they'll do anything to get it back. That's very dangerous. So I hope that this book will help interrupt that narrative and get us to really think about what it's going to take to move forward, because that's what we have. We have one group that's saying we want the country back, which is a directional reference to the past, And then there are some of us who were saying, wait a minute, we can't go back. We have to look forward. What is that going to look like, and how do we get there? As far as the issue with incarceration and particularly high-profile cases like the Angola 3, like Lamia and others, I think that, you know, on the one hand, it has been, and I think I was somewhat cynical about this many years ago, or if not cynical, skeptical, of the value of highlighting particular cases of particular prisoners, particularly when those prisoners were at least in part, if not in whole, incarcerated because of their political identities. I used to think that that wasn't going to really move the ball forward in talking about incarceration in the larger justice system because it was too limited to an individual case or the case of a handful of people. And I've come to appreciate how valuable it's been in many ways, because when you can put human faces on those who have been unjustly incarcerated, whether it's these cases or any number of others, as you think about the, you know, several hundred people now who have been exonerated from death rows around the country, whose stories, we don't all know their names, but we've certainly heard these stories, and it seems like there's another story every couple of weeks coming out. When you get to know their personal stories, it does have a profound effect on our consciousness. It humanizes the incarcerated. You know, it means more to know the name of an incarcerated person than it does to know that there's, you know, a couple million people under lock and key right now. Like, that number, you know, just doesn't register with people the way that a human face, a human name, a human story does. So I think that the value of this in the last 30 or 40 years, really talking about particular cases, and really this goes all the way back probably to, you know, the unjust trials for Huey Newton and Angela Davis and others in the Panther movement, and for Angela, of course, as the head of the for a while lead person within the Communist Party and one of our great, you know, activists in our country's history. Those unjust political trials of people like Angela and Huey Newton were examples, I think, right, that galvanized an awful lot of people, and not just around their cases, but around the larger problems with the justice system. So I think that these things have proven to be quite valuable, and if they can get us to focus again on the inherent injustice of mass incarceration, the inherent injustice of prisons as a mechanism of social control, then all the better. And I think they've done that. And so I think in the long run, this is a very valuable tool, and considering how many millions of people are locked up and how many, you know, tens of thousands of those are no doubt innocent of the charges for which they've been incarcerated, and even those who are guilty of the charges for which they've been incarcerated are often in for exorbitant amounts of time that bear no relationship to the risk that they pose to society. Huge numbers, of course, for nonviolent offenses. We've really got to have a rethink of how we deal with lawbreaking. You know, we have to have a rethink of what's really best, not just for the victims of crime, who certainly need to be considered in this, but also for the society as a whole. We're certainly not making the country safer and a more responsive and compassionate place by incarcerating 2 million people. It's not working, if you will. And so on a practical level as well as an ethical level, we need to rethink it. And if talking about those individual cases helps us do that, then all the better.
Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for this great conversation so early in the morning.
No problem.
Looking forward to, you know, what's next, you know, sort of on your easel of work, and you know, your books are always always looked forward to with a great expectation, and so far they have not disappointed, you know, some of your fans, among them, you know, I would include myself among them. And yeah, my favorite book is your White Like Me. Yeah, and really, really loved teaching that. My students really loved it as well. And and some of them who had already transferred from the College of Alameda were calling me and telling me that you were going to be speaking at Cal State East Bay, and they went to see you, which was really nice. Yeah. So anyway, thank you for your continued work.
Thank you.
And thank you again for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hope to talk to you again.
All right. You take good care.
Okay. You too.
Peace and blessings.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. So that was Tim Wise speaking about his book, White Like Me, and that was earlier this year. I'm trying to think, what was that? I think that was in Is that March? Yes, that was in March this year. We are going to continue with some of our interviews from the archives, and the one that we're going to play right now is Susan Hayward, who is going to be speaking about race, David Mamet's book, play, at the American Conservatory Theater. Also, this was last year. This was in 2011. And, she plays one of, I believe there might have been three or four characters in the play, but it's the play is called Race, and it's quite in-your-face and provocative, similar to ACT's current play, The Scottsboro Boys, which tells the story of this this horrific travesty of justice in the case of nine African American youth in 1931, which I believe the young men went to trial 9 or 10 times, and when the last of the nine then men were released, I believe he was in his mid-30s. So they spent most of their lives behind bars, being shifted from one prison to another, except for the younger boys who were released a little bit sooner. But they all spent a lot of time in prison based on the false accusations of two white women who cried rape. And during that particular period, if a white woman says that a black man raped her, she needed no proof. Just her word was enough. So ACT. ACT brings, race was really provocative, and the Scottsboro Boys is also provocative, which is really, but another thing that makes it extremely provocative is that it's in the form of a musical. And so, yeah, and not only a musical, it takes another form that is, it takes the form of a vaudeville, where in the historic sense, vaudeville, the African-American character was portrayed by white actors in blackface. So anyway, look for my review of that. I haven't written it yet. In some ways it works, and in some ways it doesn't. But then you look at audience, and you look at who's telling the story, and I definitely think that the lyrics in the songs are definitely provocative and well done, and the music and the lyrics are John Kander and Fred Ebb, the book by David Thompson, and the direction of the choreography is phenomenal. It is absolutely fabulous, and the choreography and direction is Susan Stroman. And I think that works really well. And the costuming and the staging is also great. But I see a couple of areas where it could be tweaked a little bit to make it work for me better. So here is Susan Hayward talking about race.
So tell me about this play, Race. I mean, what a provocative title.
I think the playwright's pretty interested in being provocative.
Well, I guess the short speech is that it takes place in the law offices of Lawson and Brown. It's this part law partnership. One partner's white, one partner's black. And they wake up one morning to find the hottest news story has walked into their office. A rich white billionaire is accused of raping a young black woman. And it's about the two partners and their recently hired law associate, a black woman, trying to scramble to figure out if they should take the case. If they do take the case, how would they argue it? How would they try to defend him? And the situation brings up everybody's particular prejudices and beliefs that they have about race.
and kind of puts it in the forefront when usually we're able to kind of operate behind closed doors with that kind of thing.
Wow, and you are that young woman, huh? That's who you portray.
Yeah, I portray the young law associate.
Wow, that is so amazing. Gosh, it reminds you of, there's this play, and I can't remember the name of it. I'll have to go back in my memory banks. But it was based on a true story, but what happens is this woman sort of, it is. It's another one of Lynn Nottage's, the Fabulation.
Oh, Fabulation.
It's not a
love
rape.
Lynn
but
Nottage stuff.
Yeah. Well, I know you do. You were in Ruined.
Yeah.
Yeah, so who, were you in Ruined that came out here to Berkeley Rep?
I was not. I joined the company after they opened in Chicago, and I was able to understudy for them while they were in New York. Originally, I had hoped to play the role of Sophie.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, it actually worked out because in the end, I got to understudy Sophie and Salima. And oh my goodness, the third one. Skipping my brain. I'm thinking of Charisse, the actress, and that's how the character.
Yeah, Sophie Salima and Mama Nadi. And then we have Josephine, who likes, because we just read the play in my class.
Oh, my goodness. How old are the students?
College.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad. I'm so glad that play is getting consumed by as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily enough, I got to understudy all the girls, except for my mom and Adi, and I was able to go on for all three. So
you did? You played all three of the women?
All three.
Oh, my. Wow.
Amazing.
Whoa. Like, not all in, like every night you were in a different one, right?
Not every night. There were a couple times because the cast had been doing the show since Chicago. So they've been doing the show for months. And there was a time when they got pretty tired. So I was glad that I was able to step in when they needed me to, so give them a rest, you know.
Mm. Wow. And now what's your character's name?
It's funny. My character's name in Race is Susan as well.
No. Oh, that's too funny. Has this ever happened to you where your character was your name?
You know, this is the first time. This is the first time.
Wow. So what do you do? Wear some kind of crystal to separate or what?
You know what? This character takes herself into places I would never, ever go. I think, you know, she has a really deep love of justice. And she's really in love with the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of her journey in the show, I don't think it would give away too much enough to talk about how she has a real hard time trying to figure out if the law always gives justice. I think, you know, being a minority in this country, we know that law and justice don't always go hand in hand. So for her, this character, to put herself in that position to really, really try and make that work, that's something that I give her a lot of credit for. I stick to the arts and you know, try to help the system from outside and not really from inside.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And is it a contemporary set? Like, are we in 2011?
We're in 2011. The playwright, it's very interesting. You know, usually, you know how it is when you read the beginning of the play, the playwright can be very specific about the setting and where it takes place. David Mamet was really quiet. He starts the play, it says interior office, and then the dialogue starts. So he's left it way up to the artistic team to decide where we are, what city we are, what time we are. We had a lot of conversations about what time period and what city. And I think we've definitely decided that we're in present day. And we've kind of let the audiences try to figure out where in America we are. I think David Mamet might be trying to make a point that it's a snapshot of all of America, not one particular place in America.
Right, yeah. There are, you know, audience talk exchanges, because there's no intermission on the play. It's, what, 90 minutes?
That's right.
And I was wondering when I was looking, like, why do they have all these, like, psychiatrists and attorneys? And now I know. Okay. Makes sense. Like, okay. It's really interesting. So Mamet, he's sort of looks at a lot of controversy. And this particular play hasn't necessarily been well received if you look at the reviews. I was wondering, why did he want to sort of broach this topic, about race and and sexual exploitation, you know, in violation. Why do you want to, you know, stage it like this? Why, you know, did he talk about, you know, sort of why this play now?
Well, I feel like, well, one, I think it's, we always have to talk about it. I think we get mm-hmm. ourselves in a lot of trouble when we stop having difficult conversations, when we just decide that everything's okay and the status quo should be as it is, and we stop challenging ourselves to go deeper. So I think any piece of art that makes us ask tough questions, I think mm-hmm. it's important. If it makes us uncomfortable, whether it's well-received or not, if it's a conversation starter and makes people ask questions that they normally wouldn't have, I think I did my job. I think that's what I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now, more than ever, working with the play, it really made me realize that even though the title is Race, there's all these things that are mixed up in, you know, one, the lies that we tell ourselves about people based on their race,
mm-hmm.
and how we present ourselves to the world based on race. And it's not, you can't just kind of separate that one thing about a person. It's also their social economic status. It's also, you know, are you a male or female? That has a huge effect on how you move through the world as well. And so while race might be the spark or the thing that's difficult to talk about,
mm-hmm.
it opens it up to talk about the conversation, to talk about who we are and how we are with each other.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. So I was reading that you received your acting training at Carnegie Mellon University and at the Moscow Art Theater School of Acting.
Well,
Moscow.
I got to spend a semester in Russia.
Okay. Yeah. So are you a New Yorker? Where are you from?
Well, I say I'm from the East Coast. I spent my childhood split between Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania, and Charleston, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And then now after school, I'm based in New York. That's kind of where I'm based. So I'm all over the East Coast,
right.
North, South.
Yes, you have a, you know, sort of a perspective on American culture.
Well, yeah, a very particular one. Being out in San Francisco has made me realize just how East Coast I am. I didn't really know.
Yeah, but you're in the land of Wall Street takeover, right? Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah. It's been real interesting to be away from New York and be outside of it, to watch that kind of start there and spread.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited to go back and see what it's like firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so have you had taken a stroll over to Occupy San Francisco or caught the BART over to Occupy Oakland? Or?
You know, I haven't. I've been kind of wrapped up in the show, and then when I'm off, I've kind of been enjoying, you know, very mindless, light things. But I am planning on getting over there before I leave. Have you been able to go?
Oh, yeah. There was a speak out against police brutality on Saturday because, you know, they exploded noise bombs in Oakland last week on Monday, and then they just went crazy with tear gas, you know, injuring lots of people. I saw this woman who was bruised on her leg from a rubber bullet, and I've never seen what the damage a rubber bullet does. I mean, her whole thigh was black.
Oh man.
Yeah, and then tomorrow is the general strike, calling for everyone in Oakland to not show up for work. Yeah, so I'm giving my students, I tell them, well, if you want to take an excuse after, because I'm in Alameda, even though Peralta Community Colleges is Oakland,
mm-hmm.
I'm in Alameda, and we have two colleges in Oakland and one in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So I tell them, you can take the day off and have an excuse after, just write something about it. So.
Just make it sound good on paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, write my little essay. Yeah, so it should be interesting to see what happens, like, you know, what percentage of people are going to actually participate in, you know, be able to send the city government a message that, you know, we're not going to tolerate this, you know, this excessive use of force, when they could have just spoke to the people, you know, who were, you know,
mm-hmm.
occupying, you know, City Hall Plaza. Yeah, so anyway, so it should be interesting, you know, it's about as interesting as your play.
Well, probably much more interesting.
Sort of a different type of interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, one thinks about, you know, rape as a weapon of war or, a tool to use to manipulate and control one's movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you think people are, like, you think about, you know, this character you're portraying, you know, she's at the top of her game. She's an attorney, but yet she's not insulated or safe from that. You know, what does that say about, you know, our society? What does that say about, you know, the world we live in? And, yeah, I was wondering, you know, sort of what do you think about that? Tell us more about your character.
Oh, wow, that was a lot.
You can take it off in little pieces.
I guess I could start with using, you know, rape as a weapon of war.
Mm-hmm.
Without giving away too much of, you know, what happens in the show, the the sexual relationship, I'll say it like this. I was I attended a talk back with a whole lot of lawyers after the show, after one performance, and one female lawyer brought up the idea that the show talks about the definition of rape. For a long time, rape was, you know, someone, a man physically forcing a woman to engage in intercourse. And then the term date rape came along and said that, you know, if someone you knew forced you to have sex, that included rape as well. And then after that, it was, you know, the idea that a husband could rape his wife. You know, for a long time, it was just a husband getting what he deserved, you know. And in this instance, the lawyer said that, you know, maybe the idea of engaging in, you know, paying for sex is another form of rape. If you've got a woman who has no other option to support herself but then to sell her body, is that another form of rape and exploitation?
Hmm.
So that, when she brought up that point, that was a very interesting, you know, topic to bring up to see if we can expand that idea of rape and maybe go towards ending the sex trade in general, which I would certainly be supportive of. So there's, I think that is one thing. I think, you know, this character, she knew when she was signing up to be a lawyer that she was entering a man's world. You know, there's an old boys club. There's going to be a very long, long climb up a very long mountain that's stacked against her. So I think she's very sensitive of her position in this world as a woman and as a black woman. I think a lot of people, depending on who they are and what they bring to the show, are going to decide that she's either overly sensitive because of who she is, or that she is right on the money and that she should be speaking up and speaking out about the prejudices that are against black people and women in that kind of environment.
Hmm.
So, it's a lot.
Was she surprised at the, you know, at her reception? This woman, I was looking at some of the other cast. She could talk about the ensemble, you know, who the other members are of the cast. She's not the only black person in the firm.
That's correct.
She's the only woman, but she, well, I don't know, maybe not, but maybe they're mentioned of women. But
we've decided that she is. We've decided that it's just a very small law firm consisting of the three lawyers.
Okay. And I don't know if it's an old law firm that's been around for a while, and she's like sort of doing, I mean, by them hiring her, they're doing something, or maybe not. Have you decided on that too?
We did. We talked about it. There's one line in the play that says the two partners have been running the firm for 20 years.
Okay.
So while it wouldn't be old money, you know, one of those generational old firms, it's the culmination of these two partners' life's work. They've worked together for 20 years, and I do think that bringing on some fresh blood, a young associate, a female associate, for them is making a large move into the future for them. And I'm excited to hear what you have to say about the relationship between, you know, the young black woman and the older, more established black man and their relationship. There's definitely at least a generational gap that causes tension in their relationship, and perhaps a gender-based one as well.
Yeah. So is she naive, or does she know sort of what she's up against with regards to being an attorney in the first place and then going into this all-male environment?
Well, it goes back and forth. It's one of the I don't know, it's one of the hard things about this show, and one of the fun things about this show is that Mamet gives you clues or enough, you know, meat to tell whatever story you want. I was working with the casting director on this piece, and he said, it's a choose-your-own-adventure. Because in one scene, someone will say something that's like, well, that's an incredibly naive thought. You got to be kidding me. And then in the very next scene, there'll be a very sophisticated, worldly, almost cynical point of view expressed by the same character.
Mm.
So it's like, how do you reconcile those two points of view in one character? It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a part of her that, and maybe it's a part of America too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a metaphor for how naive on one hand America can be sometimes, but also how really cynical and harsh and cold America can be as well. So
mm-hmm.
I think personally my character flips back and forth. There are some things that she believes very, very deeply and perhaps is naive about, and then there are other things that she's very hard and cynical and unchanging about as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like people.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. Yeah, I want to let our audience know we're speaking to Susan Hayward, who portrays Susan in Race. And Race is being performed open on October 21st, and it continues through November 13th, real short run,
mm-hmm.
at the American Conservatory Theater, 415 Gary Street in San Francisco. And you can visit the website, act-sf.org, or call 415-749-2228. You have Tuesday performances, huh?
Sorry?
Did I notice that you have Tuesday performances or not?
We do. We have Tuesday performances. They are earlier than the rest of the week. I believe they're at 7 p.m.
Right, right. Yeah. In closing, I just wanted to mention Haiti because we're coming on the one-year anniversary of the earthquake, and people are still not housed, and a lot of women are vulnerable to rape. I mean, they were vulnerable under previous administrations because rape is used as a way to intimidate women who are courageous and active in sort of having a say around, you know, what goes on in their lives and what they want to see in their country. And so I met women when I visited last year who have been raped multiple times under, you know, before the earthquake and, you know, the various administrations, they were raped. And then I met really young girls who were raped, you know, who are in the camps. And they've got two organizations where the women have actually gone to the UN and told their stories to the UN to get, you know, this documented about, you know, rape in the camps and rape being used again as a tool of suppression of women's voices. And they have these whistles that they blow so that if they blow the whistle, somebody might be able to come in and intervene and assist them. But a lot of times when I speak to, you know, various Haitians visiting the United States, you know, activists, you know, people that are Lavalas or, you know, not necessarily supportive of the regimes that were in cahoots with, like, the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They would talk about rule of law and how, you know, one must uphold the rule of law if you want to have any kind of order in society. And I just wanted to know if we're talking about your character, Susan. Why did she decide to go into law? Was it because she wanted to serve humanity, like she a constitutional lawyer, and or did she want to just make the money? Did she want to move up in the power structure? Because lawyers are pretty important. A lot of you know, our presidents were attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, why did she decide to do this?
There's a line in the show.
Mm-hmm.
That the line is, I thought, it's of Susan's, and she says, I thought lawyers existed to seek justice.
Mm, okay.
And it's really interesting in the way Mamet wrote it, too, because he's capitalized lawyers, and he's capitalized the J in justice as well.
Mm.
And so I feel like for Susan, it was a hook into why she thinks lawyers exist. I think it's right on the money with upholding the rule of the law, and that the law is the practical form of justice, and it's to protect justice and to seek it out wherever it may be lacking. And I think that's why she got into law, and I think that's why this case is so very difficult for her, because justice
with this particular case, it's so convoluted.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely think she got into law to seek justice.
Mm-hmm. Right. So describe sort of like the mood of the piece. Is it really serious? Because I was reading something in the press release. I'm like, hilarious.
I know, right?
I'm like, hilarious.
That's exactly what I thought. Oh, my goodness. When I first heard the what's the word? The setup
mm-hmm.
and the setting for the show. It's like, you got it. How is this a comedy? How can it be funny?
Yeah.
In rehearsals, we weren't sure. We were pretty convinced we had a tragedy on our hands,
mm-hmm.
and we rehearsed it as such.
Okay.
And so we were actually very surprised when we first put it up in front of an audience. It was very serious, very fast-paced, very mm-hmm. dark, we thought, and people were laughing.
People laugh.
People have
wow.
had a really good time. So
you have a good time.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm wondering. I'm still not sure why. I'm not sure if it's because these characters say some things to each other that I think no one would ever say in real life.
Mm-hmm.
There's some shocking, terrible things. But you know, I guess it's the same way in. I don't know, in some of our funniest sitcoms, when people say outrageous things,
mm-hmm.
we either laugh out of recognizing that some people think that or out of being uncomfortable. But people certainly laugh and have, and I'm not quite sure why. But I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, when I saw that, I thought, well, this is not a myth. I mean, that's what she said, because I'm sure they didn't make a mistake, because this is the artistic director. They wouldn't mm-hmm. misquote Carrie. hilarious. Okay.
I'd also be interested to see if the more African-Americans we got in that audience,
mm-hmm.
Where the laughs would come and from
yeah.
whom they would come. You know,
mm-hmm.
we all bring different things into a theater when we come, and so I'd be very interested in seeing what a very mixed audience laughed at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, definitely, I will let you know after I see it tomorrow evening.
Great.
Yeah.
Be sure to come around, to the stage door,
mm-hmm.
and they'll let you in, and we can, you know, chat mm-hmm. up in the green room.
That'd be super. Okay. Wow. This has been so wonderful. Sorry, I have to run off to a class. But we can have another conversation at some other time about, you know, why you decided to be an actress in the first place.
Oh dear, that's a long conversation. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, maybe we can. Maybe once I see the play, maybe we could talk again.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love
All right.
To.
You take care, and I look forward to meeting you tomorrow.
You too, Wanda. See you then.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
With that, again, was Susan Hayward talking about her role in David Mamet's play Race at ACT last season, and she played a really wonderful young black woman attorney who was hired by this firm with two men that had been together for a long time, and they get this case. Or a person comes to them, potential client comes to them, who has been accused of raping a black woman. And he's a rich man, he's married, and he's got a lot to lose with regards to his reputation if they can't get the woman to drop the charges and they actually have to go to court and go to trial. And so while they're trying to figure out the senior attorneys are trying to figure out whether or not they're going to take the case and whether or not the man is telling the truth. They have the young attorney, her name is Susan as well, just sort of, you know, fill out the client who actually, it's really wonderful the way Mamet sort of uses, you know, sort of these various sexual innuendos coming from the client as well as from the senior attorney, one is white and one is black, and looking at how race and sex are almost blurred entities in American culture. One's race and one's sex are often blurred, and then when you think about justice, you know, that is colored as well by the race of the potential client. And in this case, you know, there's a black woman, there's a red dress, there's a lot of money, there's talk of, is it the first time, is it the second time, is, you know, what's consensual versus what is not. And it's a very, very well done piece. And I was just thinking also about the Scottsboro Boys, again, ACT's current work, and that also is about race, and it's about in rape is at the center of this piece, and in this case they're white women, and of course they're innocent, and in Mammoth's race the victim is black, and of course she's guilty, and so it's interesting, you know, that one theater would have two very different types of works, and as Susan Haywood was mentioning, people did laugh at certain parts of this play, which was not a musical, and it was not set in the vaudeville form, and so it wasn't supposed to be a caricature of the justice system, as the Scottsboro Boys, I believe, is in intention. So, yeah, so if you saw Mammoth's Race and get a chance to see the Scottsboro Boys at ACT through the 14th, be interesting. It'd be an interesting juxtaposition about similar themes presented in very different ways. And I think in closing, how many minutes do we have? Oh, we have a lot of time. in closing, I think I was thinking about playing one more piece, but I think I might close with maybe I'm not certain exactly which one am I going to play. I was thinking about Seyon Kuti, and don't have all of this his pieces that I like to play. But and I also want to mention people need to get out to Oakland Museum to see Question Bridge. Really powerful exhibition where black men are in conversation with one another and we get a chance to sit and listen to them talk. And that's not something that happens a lot. So definitely want to catch that. It's up, I believe, through this month. So definitely don't want to miss that, and don't want to miss the wonderful 1968 exhibit either. That was a heavy year, and a lot of great history there as well. Let's see. I am going to play. While I'm thinking, I'm going to play Slave Masters from Africa with Fury, Africa Rise. I'm going to play that. And then look and see what I'm going to close with, which interview I'm going to close with. I'll let it be a surprise. Solo from Renee Marie's Voices of My Beautiful Country.
Privateers are not the wagon hut, are not the correction corporation, but it's the American government, and we see the link is in slavery, the continuation of slavery.
To be broken, America.
Because there was a slave owner who would punish them to death. They would kill them. but they would whip them. They did all kinds of things to punish their own slaves. They didn't need a prison. After the Civil War, the white people were removed from the prison, and they became entirely black. That is, freed slaves were imprisoned by the thousands, probably millions. So the prisons grew very quickly during the Reconstruction period. And what happened was that the prisoners were then leased to the former plantation owners. So they lost their slaves because of the Civil War. Then what they would do is go to the prison and lease black people who were in prison and use them on their plantations. And actually, the situation of those people became much worse, of the African American people, because when they were slaves, the slave owner had an interest in keeping them alive. They might whip them, put them in stocks, but they would want to keep them alive, so they had a slave. It was their property. Now they leased someone from prison. If they whipped them to death, they went back to the warden of the prison and they said, "That prisoner you sent me didn't work out. He died. Give me another one." So the plight of the ex-slaves became even worse during that period. And then that history is very important because it develops. In Angola, you could practically see it going on the ground. I haven't been at Angola, but I've done a lot of work at Parchment in Mississippi. There are guards riding horses with guns standing over prisoners who are in Mississippi in striped uniforms tending the fields. It looks like you're in the pre-Civil War South.
I like it. To keep folks on the connection that prison is just continuation of slavery, is just form of de facto slavery, is that whatever spin that any people put on it is still a continuation of slavery, and it never was abolished. And I think that is the theme. I think that is our focus. I think we have to, as being activists, and I feel it's my obligation to try to make that argument and make it kind of this. An argument that is picking up momentum and is convincing. I mean, people are able to see that. But you know what? When you really read the Constitution, when you look at the 13th Amendment, it actually didn't abolish slavery. You know, it tells you in one word that slavery, you know, will not exist on the shore in one word, but in another word, it tells you that you can be enslaved if you incarcerate people like myself. At one time, I believed that. And even during Chattel, that, you know, something was legal, it was morally correct, totally correct. And I really, you know, believe this. But I also maybe equated that it was legal to own a slave, and this was something that was immoral. And it wasn't until people saw it as being morally reprehensible that the people really got on board with it. If we really believe, if we are convinced that prison is a form of slavery and that there are people enslaved in prison, and maybe we have to look at it from a moralistic point of view. We haven't vilified legality as it is legality with regards to imprisonment, because a person can be legally, you know, imprisoned, but morally innocent, and could be legally sent to death, but stay morally. And so, we have to, I think, our focus is that prison is something that is inhuman. It's something that is because it's legal, does not give it any validity. In Angola, they got so-called, what you call prison enterprises. Now, you know, Angola is 18,000 acres of land, and they grow a lot of goods. They raise cows, chicken. At one time, there was a sugar cane factory and so forth. That was the moneymaker. But like I said, they form prison enterprises, and what they do now is punish foods and foodstuff to other prisoners. Now they have other prisons in Louisiana, and perhaps beyond, they still make the license plate that ain't going. They increase the minimum pay from 2 cents to 4 cents an hour, and so they're giving a little more money. They still pick cotton, they're still comb, because they got soybeans. I mean, you got moose, you got, and like I say, Angola is 18,000 acres, so you still have men in the field, and you still have, like enforcement in Mississippi, you have guards in Angola on horseback with guns. The same is, it really no different. And the pay may be 2 cents an hour, I mean, may have been up 2 cents, you know, minimum pay, but, I mean, this is 2009, you know, four cents an hour, and you know, if you don't get that, that 4 cents an hour, at a certain time, then, you know, that this money has to be processed in order for you to get it, it takes like 90 days for you to really receive any of that money. And if you have any type of need for any type of item that you have to supply yourself with or get out of the commissary, then, you know, you have to suffer for this. But then through the commissary, it's ran by Borough Can and the administration. They get a lot of goods into Angola in the commissary, and the money that comes from the commissary, allegedly the inmate welfare fund, it was set up years ago to go straight back to the inmate. But now the inmate welfare fund, the money that's made through the commissary, is paid, utilized to pay the salary of some of the officers, the correctional officers. There were hundreds of thousands of dollars in the inmate welfare fund before World Can took over. Now, when I left Angola, it was broke. The inmate welfare fund didn't have any kind of money in it. So this money is still money that's being made on the back of people who are suffering. In Louisiana, the legislature came up with this. It was an, I call it, legislative prerogative. They decided, as a result of so-called overcrowding in the 70s, when, as you spoke of earlier, they had already built nearly a dozen more prisons. Louisiana, like other states, they were running out of money too. So what they said, well, we got all these detention centers around the country, around Louisiana. So what they did, they enacted this clause into the prerogative to allow sheriffs around the parishes to house inmates, and these sheriffs, they would get the amount of money, which was $42 a day, that they were given for inmates, period. But if you were old and informed, it was like $100 a day that the system got. So this particular sheriff in Amid, what he would do is they were okay to perpetuate, to make sure that this money came. A lot of guys did not want to go to Angola. Angola was a place where it was considered bad. They live in Amid, 100 miles or so, 200 miles away. They wanted to stay in a close proximity with their family. So what they would do was they would get arrested and they would cop out. They would put charges on them. They would plead guilty to these charges. And then they would put them on probation. And they would let them out, go out. But see, during the Christmas season, the Christmas holidays, sometimes when the jail, when the deputies could not go out and round up enough people, enough crime, so-called crime wasn't committed to put them in jail, what he would do is say, well, okay, we're losing money. I found out from these youngsters that the sheriff would send his deputies out to round up all the parolees and bring them back and put them in jail so they could continue to accumulate the money that was being lost. And I say, wow, I went to thinking, I say, wow, you know, Louisiana has 64 parishes. I say, if you replicate this about hundreds of times, just how much money these people are making. And some of them, I say, wow. I say, speaking of slavery, and it just was a form of a continuation of slavery. I mean, money being wrought on, made on the back of people who were suffering. I look at this and I quit. I say, wow. I say, if I had any idea that the struggle had ended, or that the struggle need not continue, and that slavery had been ended, I say, this is a good indication that slavery never ended.
It's also a perfect illustration of the prison industrial complex. So these sheriffs, instead of thinking, how can I help these people who happen to fall into my jail? How can I help them go straight? They're saying, how can I keep them here and make more money? I want to get back to something you said, which I think is a profound definition of slavery, and that is that people are not human beings. That what happened with slaves, in order to do the awful things that were done to slaves, you had to think they were something other than human beings. The Constitution incorporates that. The amendment that freed the slaves excludes prisoners. Prisoners are the current slaves, and they're not treated as human beings. So that's why they, for instance, all of their skills are taken from them. They're not given any skills to make it when they get out. They're used to increase profits, etc. It's also, I believe, why political prisoners are considered so dangerous by the system. That is, King would be educating prisoners that you're a human being too. You don't need to stand for this abuse. What you should do is get together and talk about prison rape, talk about the lack of food, talk about, you know, the wages you're getting for this work, and then the kind of work you're being made to do, and the unfairness of your being sent to segregation. That's what was dangerous about the Black Panthers, is that they wanted people to organize, not be isolated, and refuse to be turned into a non-human being. You keep standing up for yourself for being a human being.
Everyone is talking about crime. Tell me, who are the criminals?
That was Robert King, the only free member of Angola 3, speaking with Dr. Terry Coopers about slavery in the United States. And today is the 4th of July, and we are considering that question that Frederick Douglass raised over 100 years ago. What to the American slave is the 4th of July? So now we're going to play a couple of songs, Umoja's piece called Our Problem to Solve, and then we're going to go out with Nova Lima's Libertad. Peace and blessings.
A problem. Marrón de hoy.